Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. You may be hearing some extraneous noise in this recording. That's because both of us have got every single window in the house as open wide as we can get. Two pets. Apparently, black cats are right in the heat, black and white cats. I found that quite strange, but I've been advised to put sun cream lotion on Smudge's ears. That's a conversation I've yet to have with the cat, but we'll see how that goes. Finley, I imagine, is panting like I am for 2 minutes from last orders of an evening, but that explains the noises. It's hot, everybody, and it's hot where you are, I imagine, as well. And there'll be people listening to this in Italy going, you think that's hot? Later in the show, we'll hear from Jim Calvely from the York City Supporters Trust about how they took ownership of the club earlier this month for about 35 minutes, it turned out, Kieran, in the end. But it's news day, and you, actually, Kieran, you witnessed some news just the other night. In fact, you witnessed a historic night for English football, Kieran, didn't you?
Yes, it was. I went along with the Baroness to watch the England versus Norway match in the Euros, and decent crowd. And we don't want to be accused of being too sort of liberal, arty farty types, but it was genuinely just so pleasant to be there with loads of young people. There are lots of women fans there. They all have their shirts on. They all have the names on the backs of the shirts for the England players. And then expecting a tough match, and 8-0.
Right.
It's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, against a good team as well. I think Kieran, even the Daily Mail would hesitate to call us liberal for supporting 50% of the population playing and watching football. I hear though that the Baroness held up the the traditional end of the game by getting slightly angry with some of the Norwegian players.
Yeah, well, halfway through the second half, we were 7-0 up at the time. and this Norwegian player went straight through one of the Norwegian centre-half, probably a bit hacked off. And we thought, that was a bit of a Sunday league tackle, straight through one of the England players. So the Baroness gets up and shouts, "You dirty northern bastards." And I'm going, you can't do that. That's my job. I'm being very magnanimous and saying, no need for that. And top Prosecco work it was.
They are fairly northern as well. I was my hat was off to Ian Wright at half time, who said the next goal was really important in this game. It was 6-0 up. I don't think the next goal's that important, to be perfectly honest. Big news in Europe though, Kieran. The European Super League and the UEFA have had their 2 days in court this week. European Super League accusing UEFA of breaking European competition rules, and UEFA calling them a textbook example of a cartel. Now, I'm not entirely sure I realise what a cartel is. I mean, the only context you'd have heard it in is when Uncle Terry was a getaway driver and they said, "Have you got the cartel?" But it's one of those words, Kieran, I've heard bandied about a lot, and I know it's negative. What exactly is a cartel, and why would UEFA accuse the ESL of being one?
A cartel is a closed group of companies which try to achieve the benefits of being a monopoly, i.e. they can set prices, they can prevent other people from competing in the industry. So there's been accusations of this in the past in things like the transport industry, where I think when Richard Branson tried to break into the transatlantic route, he said that British Airways had a cozy cartel with some of the American carriers. The prices were too high because there was an agreement, a nod-nod, wink-wink agreement. And this is the accusation that's forming part of UEFA's defence, that if we take a look at the Super League franchise project, it was broadly by invitation only, and therefore the people who were making the decisions in Super League would be able to dictate distribution of money to prevent any potential genuine competition from making headway, and so on. So it's a really important legal case, because although all of the Super League clubs have promised that they won't do it again, we've seen with people from other industries that promises are not necessarily kept. And if we take a look at the Premier League, it says that if any club does leave to join, or any club does enter a non-UEFA competition, then those clubs are going to be fined. Well, yeah, these clubs can afford the fines. I'm still a little bit uncomfortable. All of the six clubs from the Premier League are still co-owners, shareholders in the Super League company. That might be trying to get their way out of it. But as far as the hearing was concerned, it lasted 2 days. It was before 15 judges.
Yeah,
that is Silver Tongue City. Yeah. Can you imagine the hourly rate on that? Who by all accounts asked questions. The claims which are being put forward by the Super League, and I've got to be honest, some of the criticisms raised by the Super League do have merit. If it wasn't for the fact that they're not doing it for altruistic reasons, they're doing it for pure greed.
Yeah.
That UEFA is a monopoly in terms of competitions, in terms of distribution. But anybody can enter a UEFA competition, and I think UEFA name checked Eric Cantona, who said that it's bloody hard to get there. Yeah, whereas with the Super League, you simply have to get an email to say, "Fancy you in it for next season," and just turn up.
Yeah.
But the decision will not be made until December, or rather, the ruling will not come out until December. If it goes in favour of Super League, it would effectively allow anybody who wants to set up a competition in rivalry to UEFA to do so. What were those motives would be, we don't know, but I suspect it will be financially orientated. Supporting UEFA appeared to be most of the European governments.
Yeah,
I think they realise this, but we're not out of the woods yet. And I don't want to sound too beat, sorry, too downbeat even, but there's no guarantee in terms of how the judges are going to reach their conclusion. I've seen 12 angry men. You only need one of them who's very persuasive to turn around the majority.
Yeah, you've been to the Porton's Arms, Kieran. You've seen more than 12 angry men in your time. If you'd been there after you equalised against us with another 30 seconds of the 8 minutes of added time on, so are you implying, Kieran? Because there will be listeners worried that should the European Court of Justice find in favour of the Super League that UEFA are operating a monopoly, does that imply then that the six British clubs might start to look favourably again, even though they've promised that they would never ever consider looking at breaking away?
I think they will find it very difficult to do so, because they've all given pledges, but I don't trust anybody these days in power. Because people in power have been known to lie.
Mm. Yeah, that's that's the only response I have to that is there is nothing you can add to that. Really, I wish we were doing the I Got News for You at the moment. So many things.
You can imagine.
We are supposed to be entirely impartial when it comes to things like the European Court of Justice and indeed fraud trials. But I must admit, Kieran, to a little frisson of disappointment when I heard this news, I'm afraid, because former FIFA president Sepp Blatter and Vice President Michel Platini have both been found not guilty following their fraud trial in Switzerland.
Yes, yes. And this all comes down to a gentleman's agreement and a contract. We do have some of our silver-tongued lawyer friends who listen. And a contract can be verbal. And the defense of Platini and Blatter was that they had a gentleman's agreement that Michel Platini, who by all accounts was on a salary of only 300,000 Swiss francs a year in 1998, so we're talking 25 years ago, for a man of his means, that was quite a modest salary, and that was below his market rate, and I think there is actually some merit in reaching that conclusion. So at the time, UEFA was FIFA was skint, and therefore what happened was that Blatter said, we will pay you when we've got more money, and I will up your salary for the 1998-2002 period. And I'll upgrade it to around about 1 million Swiss francs per year. Platini didn't get around to asking the money for another 10 years. Mm. So I'm thinking, well, yeah, if somebody owed me 2 million, I would probably, we all forget things. Probably wouldn't be one of the things like, oh no, I've forgotten about that. Yeah. The money was paid across to Platini in 2011. So the verdict of the trial judge was that I think it was a female judge, said the market value, I'd expect it to be higher. There is no evidence to the contrary that this salary existed, or rather this payment existed as far as UEFA were concerned, but then it wouldn't be, because you would have thought that Sepp Blatter might have said something to FIFA itself that, by the way, I've agreed to pay Platini, but perhaps he forgot to tell FIFA and Platini forgot to remember to collect it. There's a lot of forgetful people around. And again, they're not the only people. We've only got to look at our is he our present prime minister? He does seem very forgetful himself.
Yeah.
Again, people in power just seem to have very, very poor memories. Platini and Blatter have been found not guilty by this judge. Platini is an angry Frenchman, which I think actually is a euphemism from the Vis Profanosaurus. Was that an angry pirate? I can't remember. Angry pirate. Oh yeah, I'll tell you that one afterwards. Then in addition to this, Sepp Blatter, who's 86, was sort of just trying to be as charming and charmless as he tends to be. He says, hey, I'm completely innocent of everything. He's forgetting, of course, that he is subject to a separate prosecution in respect of a $1 million payment to the Football Association or peoples connected to Trinidad and Tobago. Now, I used to teach in Trinidad. And anybody who knows about the activities of Jack Walker, who is I still don't think he's allowed to go to the US because he will be put in handcuffs or walk if he goes there. He is somebody who has been involved with football administration, and he makes Laurence Bassini seem like a nice guest for dinner.
Oh, that's interesting because that's a link to our next story. But before we get there, Kieran, I just think angry pirate. I'm guessing because he used the hand with the hook by mistake. Is it anything to do with that?
I think so. Could be.
Do you know, there's so much forgetting in that story between Sepp Blatter and Platini. It makes you wonder when post-it notes were invented. I'm fairly sure every now and again, if I have a lot to drink at night, I will leave notes for myself in the morning, like, don't forget to record pod, things like that. Get milk, feed cat. I'm fairly sure I would add, get that 2 million quid to the Sepp Blatter.
You would think so, wouldn't you?
Just somewhere you'd put it in. You'd put it somewhere you'd see it visibly. I'd tell Ali, she'd remember. Anyway, a bit of a spoiler alert, because the next news is about Lawrence Pessini. And I think it's safe to say you can label this under the "you don't say" part of this pod. The EFL says it's not received any paperwork in relation to the proposed takeover of Birmingham City from Lawrence Pessini, nor indeed in regards to him offering to fight Simon Jordan for £1 million, which there was a lot going on last week news-wise, but how that slipped under the radar, I don't know. That's the most remarkable thing. Tell that four-letter word, Jordan, I'll fight him for £1 million. And this man wants to take over Birmingham City. So anyway, so it seems like someone's it's in the realms of fantasy, which I think is good news for Birmingham City, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We know the Watford story. What's known as Safegate, and for discreet reasons, we won't tell it on air.
And for legal reasons, Kieran, we've made this perfectly clear that we can't tell it for legal reasons. Yeah,
yeah. Come to the live show.
I still don't know. I'm sure that's not an actual loophole, but there you are. Yeah.
Lawrence Pessini went on TalkSport with Jim White and Simon Jordan last week, and he says he had huge news, and he proceeded to say that he had huge news for 4 minutes without actually saying anything. He then started to say that he owned a large number of properties in London's Swanky, Oxford Street, without a lot of evidence to back that up. He said he had £30 to £35 million, which was in the hands of a lawyer, which was going to go to buy Birmingham. And when asked, had he been in touch with the EFL, he then sort of talked around the houses. My understanding from, should we say, sources close to the EFL, was along the lines of, over our dead bodies, will he pass the owners and directors test? Now, we have to try to be objective and analytical here. And also, part of me thinks Lawrence Pessini has become a figure of fun. I genuinely think this guy needs professional help. Because if you saw the way he was talking, and then his response, and yes, it's all a bit of a giggle, but in order to pass the owners and directors test, does he have any unspent convictions? No. Whilst he's been declared bankrupt twice, those are now spent convictions. I think the issue would be in respect of providing proof that he has what's known as future funding. Now, there have been talks and also there were claims made by Lawrence Pessini that David Sullivan at West Ham was somehow going to be funding him the money. Yeah. We all know that David Sullivan can walk away from West Ham in around about a year's time and doesn't have to give any of the profits back to the local authorities under the terms of the agreement. Having asked around a few people who know a lot more about these things than me, the response that came back to me, and this was quite unequivocal, David Sullivan wants to maintain his investment and his connections to West Ham. It's more connected to his roots. I believe his son is connected with the club. His son is completely, is a big West Ham fan. And there's no desire to acquire Birmingham. Now, that's not the same to say that he's not lending money to Lawrence Pessini, but David Sullivan is many things. He's not a fool.
No.
And if I was looking at a list of people to whom I would lend money, where I would have a lot of confidence of getting that money back, I think it's fair to say Lawrence Pessini would not be near the top of that list. So, we await developments. We have offered Lawrence the opportunity to speak to us on the show, as we know. And to be fair to us, he got a very polite reply. And he says, yeah, when the deal's through, he'll come on and he'll have a chat. The offer is still there. And that's where we are at present.
Part of me would love to speak to him, Kieran, and part of me is terrified at the prospect. But you make a very fair point. While we do laugh at it, some of the things he says are quite clearly, for want of a better word, deranged, aren't they, really? And there must come a stage when somebody puts an arm around his shoulder and says, look, if you can't back these claims up, then we need to stop making them in public. And perhaps he does need to get some help. Or perhaps he's just enjoying the attention and he's taking us all for fools. We don't know. But
yeah,
you can't imagine David Sullivan, who, as you say, is many things, but he's a very shrewd businessman, would go anywhere near him, even though he has emotional ties from his years of ownership at Birmingham City. But the next story, Kieran, is a very intriguing one, mainly because of the scale of the numbers involved. 329 professional footballers are being investigated by the FA and the UK taxman for alleged tax avoidance. Do we know the scale of it, Kieran? And is the implication that these 329 professional footballers are all involved in one particular scheme, or is it just suddenly randomly almost the whole of the Premier League, if it is in one division, are being investigated by the FA?
Well, I think it's more of an HMRC thing. We've discussed this before, that the HMRC do have a special weapons and tactics division that investigate high net worth individuals and unusual payment distributions. Now, I think there are two issues as far as the football industry is concerned. First of all, and we've discussed this before, the issue of image rights. What many players are doing is they are having a proportion of their total remuneration paid across to image rights companies, which are set up on their behalf, normally by their advisors. Sometimes these are set up overseas, so trying to get traction on them is more difficult. But the earnings generated by image rights are subject to corporation tax. Now, you pay corporation tax at 19%, but then when the image rights company pays out money, it does get taxed again. So I think some of the stuff which we've seen in the media has perhaps been a little bit incomplete with regards to the money. But the image rights companies could, in theory, pay out dividends rather than to the players themselves. It could be to the families of players. It could be to the partners of players. It could be the children of players. And I'll be honest, this happens in many other industries as well. Yeah. So we're not saying it is unique to football. Whereas income tax, if you are a Premier League footballer, the vast majority of your income, I think effectively, if you paid more than 150 grand a year, you're being taxed at 45% in terms of income tax. So there's a way of reducing the tax. Football players are still paying a lot of tax, though. The other issue is in respect of agents' fees. Yeah. Now, in terms of agents' fees, and I should have spoken to either Jonathan or Craig, or I've been teaching all day long, but I should have really spoken to them in respect of this. If an agent negotiates on behalf of a player, what we sometimes see is the club pays the agent. Now, some people are saying, I think within the tax authorities, well, actually, the agent's negotiating on behalf of the player, and therefore that should be a taxable benefit in respect of the player, upon which his tax is then charged, and has this resulted in less tax being paid because football clubs lose money and therefore they don't pay any tax effectively on the money that they give to the agent. HMRC estimates that since 2015, if these stories that I'm reading are correct, that it has collected £560 million from the football industry in respect of additional tax revenue. So clearly a very significant amount of money. At the same time, the football industry is a wealthy industry, as we know. I've always defended an individual footballer's rights to earn money.
Yeah, so what you're saying is these are historical cases that are being investigated. So this it's not a case of a whole group of players investing in a film industry, for example, to get round tax. It's just HMRC are catching up with loopholes, essentially.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yes. They're catching up with the way that the system has been set up, and there is no perfect tax system. Many years ago, I used to teach tax, and the Chancellor would bring out a few rabbits and tweak a few things in every budget, and you'd just spend two or three days with your colleagues saying, well, that works, that reduces, we can move into that, and so on. It was sort of a game of whack-a-mole. There's no perfect system.
Yeah, I'm still trying to work out how candidates for the leadership of the Conservative Party can say that cutting tax completely, listen, let's just have no tax. Yeah, we find that's a really good idea, and then somehow we'll magically pay for all sorts of stuff. But professional footballers, of course, will argue that they're not experts on financial matters, and they're just guided by their agent or their financial advisor, and they just signed a bit of paper that was put in front of them. And I'm guessing most of the footballers being investigated will be wealthy enough to pay whatever back tax or penalty they are asked to do.
If they are currently still playing, yes, entirely.
Oh, yeah, of course, I hadn't thought of that.
We all know players who are no longer in the game whose finances are not as good as many people anticipate. We had Meheta on from the PFA, and the PFA have put out a report, I think it was a couple of years ago, 40% of professional footballers become bankrupt within 2 years of retiring, which is a scary scenario. The focus is very much on players in the Premier League, and even Premier League players themselves aren't good with money. It's very well earning it, but what happens is you settle into a certain lifestyle in terms of expenditure, and that's something you can easily deal with it during your playing days. When the taps are turned off and suddenly you've got all of these ongoing financial commitments, things can reverse very quickly.
Mm. There was lots of speculation, Kieran, as to the timing of Wayne Rooney's departure from Derby. He's now the new manager of DC United in the MLS on a salary reported to be £860,000, which I'm guessing is a lot less than he would have got from even a championship club in England.
Under normal circumstances, I would say yes, but I was told, and again, we don't know anything for certain, that part of the reason why I think Wayne Rooney and Paul Stretford and so on were so enamoured with Chris Kirchner, that Wayne Rooney was offered a salary in League One and a 3-year contract, which was more than the figure you're talking about. It's certainly high by MLS standards. DC United have an absolute stinker of a start to the season. Yeah. Wayne Rooney, of course, was a player there, and he had a pretty good record as a player there. But this is all part of the final unwindings. Paul Stretford has, via his Triple S agency, has put out some form of "Where's Wally" document in respect of Chris Kirchner. Which is, I want to give you an indictment, but we're struggling to find him. I suggest St Andrews for the next 3 days might possibly help, because Kirchner does seem to sort of turn up. So he's a bit like a meerkat, isn't he? Sort of, you see a golf tournament, and all of a sudden he's only got the one jersey, and he pops up in the background. So It's a good salary by MLS standards, if it's true. I think Wayne Rooney's star has lost a little bit of its shine.
Yeah.
Over the course of the past 2 or 3 weeks, I was the first to give him plenty of praise for the job he did at the club at the time, mainly due to the fact that we were talking to people at the club and they were saying he was keeping our spirits up, and he did seem to be quite genuine when he could have walked away on many occasions.
Well, yeah, I don't think the circumstances of him leaving should tarnish what he did for Derby County while he was there. But I'm interested, Kieran, you say that Paul Stretford's looking for Chris Kirchner to issue an indictment. What sort of indictment are we talking about here?
Paul Stretford's agency, if the stories are true, paid the wages at Derby County for May 2022.
Yeah.
On the understanding that that Chris Kirchner was 95% of the way to buying the club, and everything had been signed off, and that money was effectively a loan. And then Chris Kirchner disappeared, and I'm not quite sure what he's putting out on social media because he's banned me.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're banned by a lot of people, Kieran, aren't you, on social media? Maybe we should have a pod about that. Let's just ask people to speculate on who's banned Kieran from social media. Maybe then we should be, with retrospect, a little bit more fair to Quantamar, because Paul Stretford, like David Sullivan we talked about before, is a very shrewd businessman. And if he was almost completely taken in by Kirchner, as it appears he was, then perhaps Quantamar were less naive than we thought they were.
Yes, but they're supposed to be professionals.
To be honest, Kieran, I only asked you that as I missed talking about Derby anyway. So should we move on? This next story, Kieran, is a very, very intriguing one. The co-owner of Grimsby Town, Jason Stockwood, has basically sent a warning to potential investors in the club. This seems to me unusual.
Yes. First of all, congratulations to Grimsby Town back in the EFL. They've sold 5,000 season tickets this season. They're looking to expand Blundell Park because its capacity is only 9,500. So money is needed. Jason Stockwood has certainly helped to stabilise the club, and fair play to him. And what he's doing here is, I think he's trying to put out a no wrong-uns alert. We know about the New Zealand New Zealand All Blacks no dickheads policy. Well, I think he's trying to extend that to the boardroom. And what Jason Stockwood has said is that they've received a number of offers for small investments. He said, sub 250K at a time to buy minority stakes in the club from the UK and overseas. But he says, I've done some background checks, and some of these offers were, and I quote, not the right reason. So, people, why buy a football club? And, and I've said, I've got a chapter in the book which says, love, profit, vanity, and insanity.
Yeah.
And that probably covers most of these things. When it's veering towards property, profit, and profit's normally linked to property, that's when you've got to be a little bit circumspect. So, fair play to Jason Stockwood, because he appears to be acting as the guardian of the club. And that's one of the that's one of the facets and features we like to see in club owners.
It is, but is there a danger then that he might deter other serious investors?
I think if you do the right things for the right reasons, it shouldn't be a deterrent. Is always my view.
Good,
Because you would buy into the philosophy of the club, and if anything, that would act as a magnet to people who have got the right reasons for wanting to put money into Derby.
Or even Grimsby, as long as it's not Chris Kirchner. Now, we've got two more stories left, Kieran, before we talk to Jim Calverley for New York City Supporters Trust about them buying the club. And the first of those stories is about another club that was recently bought by a supporters trust, or partly bought by a supporters trust, and it's Swindon Town. But an insolvency hearing last week was told that a loan by an American company to Swindon was in fact a sham and was actually a deposit to buy the club. Is that anything they need to be worrying about?
Well, yes, because this company, this US investment vehicle, which is called Able, or for our purposes is called Able LLC or something, it's issued a winding up petition against the football club. Now, we have to do a little bit of rewinding in terms of time.
Yeah.
Lee Power, the former owner of Swindon Town Football Club, he had a preferred buyer for the club. He was looking for an exit route, and Able was this organisation. Now, Able gave Swindon Town £100,000. Now, Able said that money was a loan, and if it is a loan, then it needs to be repaid.
Right.
In which case, Swindon need to find either 100K or the winding up issue, the winding up order, potentially can start to crank in. Swindon have said, well, we've got an issue here because this is between Lee Power and Abel. I think it's fair to say that the paperwork at Swindon is a bit sketchy.
Huh.
I think going back to the theme of forgetting, it looks as if somebody forgot to fill it in. And therefore, has the £100,000 been received? That appears to be the case. But in the views of Swindon and the present owners, that £100,000 was a non-refundable deposit put down by Abel as part of their initial negotiations to buy the club from Lee Power. So if it's a loan, then there's an issue because it needs to be repaid. If it's a non-refundable deposit, the words non-refundable kick in, and you know, off you go, Abel, and you get nothing. So it's all going to hinge on that. There's a lack of paperwork, and yeah, it could be similar to what we've seen with Platini and Blatter. It's trying to get to the bottom of things where there's in an adequate audit trail or crumb trail, however you want to describe it. Normally ends up in court, and you know, as we've said on many occasions, the only winners here are the lawyers.
Forgive me, Kieran. You've probably explained this to me before, but it's hot, and I don't work very well in the heat. But why would this money be owed by Swindon Town and not by Lee Power?
Because the money was paid, by the looks of it, the money was paid into the Swindon Town bank account.
Ah, okay.
Right. Now, it looks as if that was then used to pay the wages, or Lee Power paid the wages and then he took the money out of the club because he paid the wages. We're not quite certain because, again, struggling to find the right authorizations and approvals and so on.
Yeah, astute listeners may have noticed a brief hiatus before I asked that last question, and that's because I was trying not to sneeze. Because all the windows are open, obviously, and the pollen's coming in. And also, I was trying to remember whether or not Swindon Town were fan-owned. So I slightly panicked. They are, aren't they?
They're owned by Clem Morfuni.
Yes,
who's an Australian.
Yeah.
But we had people from the Swindon Supporters Trust,
yes.
And somebody from the Swindon Supporters Trust is now the chief executive. So yes. there is certainly influence by the fan base.
Yeah, the way my mind works at the moment, same thing. One last story, Kieran, and that's, again, to no one's surprise, the Premier League has delayed the vote on a gambling sponsorship ban.
Yes. Apparently, there was due to be a Premier League meeting last week, and one of the items on the agenda, if the press stories are true, was to be consideration for a voluntary ban on front of shirt advertising. And then issues took place as far as central government was concerned. And Chris Philp, who is the minister, I think, for tech and digital economy, he resigned because he come to realise that the Prime Minister hadn't always been particularly transparent or truthful in respect to some issues. Allegations along those lines have been made. Now, Chris Philp was, as I mean, involved with the white paper. For the sake of transparency, I've spoken to Chris Philp with regards to gambling issues in terms of football, as has Mark Palios, as have people from the Big Step, as has the gambling industry, as has the football industry. So the white paper was making progress. Chris Philp has resigned, so we're not quite sure what's happening there. And therefore, the Premier League says, well, you know, why are we talking about a voluntary ban? I think the government is reluctant to legislate for this. And it's sort of trying to put the ball into the Premier League's court. And, there's normally some sort of quid pro quo. So I spoke to somebody at a club to say, okay, come on, cards on the table, Premier League club. What realistically is it going to cost you? And the reply was, you know, if we are one of, let's be honest, the other clubs, and Brighton and Palace and Brentford and so on, all of these clubs are the other clubs.
Yeah,
you'll probably be looking realistically at say around about £7 million a season. For front of shirt from a gambling company. If it was another industry, which is not
gambling with a small g, i.e. it's not crypto or things of that nature, then he says, yeah, if I'm honest, we'd be struggling to get anything above, you know, 1.5, perhaps 2 million. Oh, wow. So there is a £5 million gap. Now, some people say, well, hold on, you know, these clubs are making a lot of money from TV, and yes, they are. £5 million a year is still a significant amount of money in terms of, you know, ability to sign players. It's realistically for a club the size of, you know, one of the other smaller 14, it's probably two players' salary. So, you know, two first team players' salary is going to be the difference. And the response was, you know, why should we give up the advertising when we're not seeing it happening in the media industry? So, you know, you get carpet bombed with adverts, pre-match, post-match. I know that there's the whistle-to-whistle ban, but the whistle-to-whistle ban's a fallacy because it's actually just a half-time ban, because that's what whistle-to-whistle means. And the programs are sponsored by gambling companies, even if there's no formal adverts. So, you know, why are we being the fall guy when the broadcasters are making a lot of money out of this? So that is the position. For my position is, I don't think a front of shirt ban is actually addressing the much broader issues of gambling. We really need to go the same way as we saw what happened with tobacco, in the 70s and 80s. And you either ban it altogether or not at all.
I mean, as we've said before, Kevin, the whistle-to-whistle ban is a nonsense because there are no commercial breaks during the each half of the game anyway. So are you saying then, Kieran, you know, Brighton have got American Express, Palace have now got Cinch. Are you saying that they can't compete financially with big gambling companies in terms of what they pay, or is it just because their deals are with Palace and Brighton rather than Man United and Liverpool?
Well, Manchester United and Liverpool aren't interested in front of shirt gambling deals,
right?
Because they are global brands.
Yeah, of course.
And yeah, the Manchester United deal with Team Viewer is worth thick end of $50 million a year. Liverpool are, I think they're still with Standard Chartered, but they are looking to get a very, very good deal. Liverpool are an incredibly sexy brand at present, and so on. So the big six clubs, it's much less of an issue for them because they're going to be unaffected. The paradox here is that those clubs already have a financial advantage over the smaller clubs, and a front of shirt ban for the likes of Palace, Brighton, and so on. We can both say that our clubs we don't have front of shirt gambling sponsors, and I think the attitude of both clubs is along the lines of, if you build up a really good commercial relationship with a sponsor, actually that £7 million a year can be recouped, but there's a limited number of sponsors that are willing to do that. Brighton are quite fortunate that American Express's European headquarters are in Brighton. So, you know, that there is a footprint. You know, my dad worked for Amex, my mum worked for Amex, my sister worked for Amex, I used to work for Amex. Everybody you know in Brighton knows somebody that works for Amex. So it is a sort of a local deal as well as a national one.
Oh, what did Uncle Terry do for Amex?
When it came to traveler's checks, he did the only $77 traveler's checks, which I'm sure it's got two S's, Uncle Tell.
Now, these are heady times for York City fans. It's their centenary year, and they've already celebrated that by getting promotion back into the National League after a long time away. And then just a few days ago, the club became 100% fan-owned for around about 24 hours. We spoke to Jim Cowley of the York City Supporters Trust to find out more about an exciting few days. This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. We are living in an era of information overload, and we have more knowledge than ever before. But what do we do with it all? If you're in Notion, you put that knowledge to work.
It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired. And all I can say on a personal level, as for somebody whose life is quite chaotic, and I'm writing pieces for government and newspapers and media content, I've got my university commitments and I'm supposed to be writing a book, I use Notion all the time because it brings order into chaos.
Well, if you need order brought to your chaos, you can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning your ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Jim, thank you very much for joining us. Before we talk about the takeover, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved with the Supporters Trust.
Yeah, so I've been a fan of York City for, well, all of my life, really. I'm one of those terrible people that has two football clubs because my dad is he's a Newcastle fan and a Geordie by birth. But living in York with two sons that were avid football fans, it was a bit expensive to go. So all the way up there. So we started watching York, and very quickly, from my perspective, I kind of preferred York a little bit more, small community club. And I've been a season ticket for quite some time. So that was how I got involved in the club. And then the Supporters Trust came around about a year ago. I think it's fair to say that things were getting a little tired with the club. We had a beginning of last season, we kind of had two shifts in terms of where the club sat in the community. I think there was a metaphorical shift within the community. It felt like it was changing a little bit. And there was a physical shift because we left Booth and Crescent and we moved out to the LNER, which we now home at. Things just came about. It became a little bit uncomfortable, and I was looking for some way of expressing that and getting involved more in the club. And the trust is such a great organisation that has always had such a heavy involvement in the club. It was kind of a natural home for me to put my energies, I guess, into realising that what had just been a release for so many years, going to the football for 90 minutes on a Saturday, I was kind of ready to get a little bit more involved, really.
The club's had a pretty torrid time in the past 20 years, starting back in 2002 when the American John Batchelor tried to turn you into York City Soccer Club.
So, God, yeah.
tell us about the context of the Supporters Club taking ownership now, just a few days ago, mm-hmm. because unusually in this situation, it hasn't really come out of the crisis, has it? It's sort of developed to outsiders, it seems, amicably.
Yeah, so it's very difficult to explain it, certainly to outsiders, without giving a short potted history of where the trust came from. So we were actually formed in 2002. Like you say, we bought the club out of administration, which was after Douglas Craig. 2003, we bought the football club, and in that agreement, when we sold the football club, we had certain protections. We bought the football club in 2003. When we sold it to Jason McGill in June 2006, when we voted on that, we put certain protections in place to ensure that if Jason ever wanted to sell the football club, the Supporters Trust were able to buy that football club back. And that's essentially what we did this time around. So it kind of was the timeline was brought forward with the sale of Booth and Crescent, but that was essentially what happened. We've had an agreement for nearly 20 years with Jason McGill that ultimately if he chose to sell the football club, then we would be the ones buying it back. We would be able to buy it back.
Immediately after the takeover then, just a few days ago, literally immediately, within hours, you sold 51% of the shares to Glenn Henderson, who you describe mm-hmm. as an investor partner. Was that always the plan?
When the opportunity came around, there was always a plan that we would need assistance with it. I think in terms of the deal that was done to buy the football club, it really wasn't going to be possible to kind of raise funds as a trust to buy ourselves and all that sort of thing. So we had to make some deals. We had to, I think our trust chairman, Mike Brown, said he had to do some wheeler dealing to make sure to pull things off. And Glenn's been involved with us, you know, has been in contact with us for nearly 4 years. So it wasn't sort of a quick decision of we have someone's approached us as an investor, we can bring him in. Glenn had evidence to us that he was interested in the football club, invested in what it is as a community, invested in us as fans. So he presented a great opportunity for us to be able to make that deal to buy the football club and increase our share as well. So we've increased our share from 25% when the club was owned by Jason McGill to 49% now. So there's advantages on both sides. But yeah, when we knew this deal was coming about, we'd already been speaking to Glenn. I think Mike's been speaking to Glenn for nearly 4 years. So he's had that time investment in the football club as well.
I like his, he talks about a model of ownership that's football and fan-centric based, which is great. But were there people in the supporters trust who felt that you should own the club entirely? Was that simply not practical in terms of the finances?
Well, so certainly I will not deny it. I'm a huge fan of the concept of fan ownership. I think we have a lot of fans at our level who are to coin a phrase, against modern football. And you know, there should always be a desire to have fans more involved, would be my argument. And I'm sure we have members that are in this situation. You know, and football wider, it is becoming harder and harder to pull that off. And as you say, with the statement that Glenn's made, putting fans at the centre of what the football club does gives us that element of confidence that we probably wouldn't be making many different decisions, and we're going to be heavily involved as we've put Alistair Smith on the board from the Sports Trust.
Are you able to tell us what sort of level of payment was involved, how much you paid for the club, and then how much Glenn paid you?
So I'm not able to go into too much detail. What is in public knowledge is already in the public service, that the agreement was that the football club would be bought back for £350,000. So that's been in the public domain since the vote in 2006 to sell the football club to Jason McGill. So that's not new information. It's an old figure, because I think it probably would generally be considered that even a National League club, as I have to remember we are now, a National League football club is probably worth a little bit more than that. But what is nice, and you know, Jason's been great throughout this whole process, is he's recognised that payment was, or it feels like anyway, from my perspective, that payment is kind of irrelevant. What's happening is the football club's going forward. We celebrate our centenary year this year, and we believe this kind of the deal and the bringing Glenn in and everything that's kind of going on at the football club that's exciting at the moment sets it up for another 100 years.
Kieran, can I bring you in here just on two things? Whether or not that's a fair price for the club would be interesting to hear, but also this idea of 51% of the club being owned by an individual and 49% by supporters, is that an unusual model, Kieran?
If we look at those in turn, in my view, 350,000, I would agree with Jim that it's bargain is perhaps too harsh a word, but it's certainly lower than I would anticipate paying for a club in York's position, especially as it's got some real estate assets, property assets, which are desirable. In terms of the 51-49 split, I think this is broadly ahead of the game in terms of where we're hoping some of the things in respect of the fan-led review are concerned. I think the German model, which is 51-49, the other way round, is more problematic, because it means that investors might be reluctant to physically put money into a club. This gives a bit more flexibility. But the most important thing is that the fans' voices can be heard by having a significant stake in the club. And that gives protection. And we've seen with so many clubs, especially clubs in the north of England, you know, we've reeled them off, haven't we? You know, Macclesfield, Oldham, Rochdale, Bolton.
and so on. So many clubs in the north of England have been subject to distress. And then, you know, we've got the destruction of Bury and Macclesfield as well. That having a scenario such as this means that the trust is involved in decision making, but also acknowledging that there is a natural ceiling in terms of what a trust can contribute to a football club from a financial perspective, whereas an external investor with 51% has the option to provide additional funding.
Jim, the outgoing owner made what seems to be a quite remarkably generous gesture, didn't he, as well, with respect to the stadium?
Yeah, so the rent has been paid on the stadium for 10 years, which is great. It certainly sets us up in a great position. I think just clicking back to what Kieran said there, I think the model that we have and the model that we've come out of slightly, which was probably slightly unique as well. It's not necessarily just about the ownership figures and what you put in. It's absolutely about the fan involvement and importantly and quite symbolically as well. It's about that makeup of the board. So previously we were supposed to have two board members elected by us or appointed by us under Jason McGill. That didn't always come through, and there was loads of reasons for that. And when we started this project with Glenn, it has gone down to an immediate 50-50 split. So and certainly for the short term future, that'll be how it remains. And in the future, when we appoint their board members, what we're looking to do is make it kind of a combined decision about who goes on there to make sure that they're beneficial for the football club. But the trust will continue to have a percentage of that board, which is essentially we can appoint ourselves as and when we need it. So I think that's a great way of making sure that right at the heart of your football club, fans are there.
I want to take you up on that a little bit more in a moment, but I just do want to come back to this notion of Jason McGill, the outgoing owner, mm-hmm. giving you a huge amount of security by paying the rent mm-hmm. for the next 10 years. Was that something you expected, or was that something that was part of the negotiations between you and him?
Yeah, so I'll be totally honest, it was a little bit of a surprise to me. I found out when the statement got released that he'd kindly done that. I haven't been intricately involved in the legal discussions, so I'm not quite sure where that came through. We haven't had we've had 2 weeks of it's been a merry-go-round, so I'm not quite sure where that came about or what point that came in. But it certainly does set us up really well, and it sets us into that path that we want, which is a sustainable football club, certainly.
Yeah, and again, Kieran, having that 10-year security is remarkable for a club at that level, isn't it?
Very much so. It allows you to plan. And you know, when you're budgeting, you say, right, well, we've got to say, put so much money to pay for the rent, so much for the rate, so much for electricity, and to take one of those core non-variable costs out of the equation is fantastic. It does allow the club to perhaps consider, you know, further investment in infrastructure, further investment in youth development, and the broader issues of the club.
So much has happened in the past 2 weeks, Jim. You buy the club one day, you sell part of it the next day. The day after that, this brilliant statement appears on the club's website, a joint statement where you talk about four pillars and 13 promises, which I think are brilliant. But you've set yourself a very high standard of governance right from the start with all the things you talk about, engaging the community, engaging fans, environmental impact, all sorts of stuff there. It's brilliant, but it's ambitious, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, football is got to be a game of ambition. You know, let's be honest, you're on the pitch, nobody's sat there wanting to draw. Why would you do it off the pitch as well? And our statement of our mission and vision, I think, bore out of one of the reasons that we wanted to make this deal in the first place. I think there's no denial that certainly our fans will know that there was a tiredness, I think, would probably be fair to say, around the connection between fans and club. There was and I spoke earlier about that metaphorical and physical change that we had at the beginning of last season. It has brought it to a head. There were a few protests at the stadium at the beginning of last season. So we were absolutely clear when all of this project started, and Mike's been clear from the very start that when we're involved in a football club, that fans have to come at the beginning, have to come at the kind of beginning, middle and end. And And why not set those standards high straight from the beginning, straight from the off? Look, this is the standard we want to be held to. I'm an elected member of the board. I will continue to be an elected member of the Sports Trust board. And if I'm not meeting those standards, then we need to elect someone that will. And I think we've already seen what's been great. The response to that statement from our fans was that this is exactly what we wanted to see. This is exactly why we had concerns at the beginning of last season. This is exactly, you know, what we want to see for our football club going forward. So yes, it's a high standard, but we're not scared of it. Fans not scared of it. We are custodians of the football club, and hold us to those standards.
I very much like the fact you talk about being guardians and you talk about being held to account as well, which is great. Also, as a Palace fan who sat through 4 years of Roy Hodgson, and I love Roy Hodgson, but I particularly like the bit in your statement where you say that one way to engage with fans is to provide entertaining football, which is great. But again, you've set the bar very high. Look, it's your 100th anniversary, as you've mentioned. You've just been promoted back into the National League. You've got this brand new ownership model. These are heady times. I mean, what's your ambition, or are you just sitting back and enjoying the moment so far?
So I'm certainly not sitting back. I haven't had time to sit back. My phone has been physically hot for the last 2 weeks with Twitter and media requests and all these kind of things. We're certainly not sitting back. You know, John Askew, our manager's, from a footballing perspective, John Askew, our manager's been pretty clear on the fact that he's not someone that likes to sit back, and neither are we. You know, we want to get on with stuff. We want to get on with stuff on and off the pitch. And I don't see a ceiling to how we work. We can always look for ways to improve. And if I know the York fans well enough, they won't settle for us just for mediocrity. They'll want us to keep pushing on and off the pitch.
And those fans really turned up in their numbers, even during those years in National League North. You were getting 6,000 or 7,000 people at home games, weren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had a friendly against Borough on Saturday, and we had over 4,000 people there. Really? Which, you know, okay, fine, Borough bought 1,200 people, but for a friendly, for a National League football club, that's pretty exceptional. We sold out for the playoff game, for the playoff games. We've consistently had kind of 3,500 to games against, and this is absolutely no disrespect to them, but games against Bradford Park Avenue, who perhaps will bring 50 fans, or, you know, the Guiseys of the world, where they're not bringing a huge number of fans, they're not bringing, you know, numbers that will bump up your average. Essentially, you're in a stadium full of York fans, and we've been really pleased with how the sports turns out. We've already sold just short of 2,000 season tickets for this season, which is an increase on last season. Things are looking good. Fans do keep coming. And to be fair, that's always been the case. You know, York fans have always turned up. They've always turned up in their numbers, and they've always looked out for the football club.
One last thing, Jim. Kieran and I, older men than you, I have to say, we were reminiscing on our last pod about your brilliant 1970s home kit, the maroon one with the white Y.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, we're doing this on Zoom, which is unusual, but you're wearing something I noticed today, a brilliant away kit. Chocolate and cream stripes, that is a fancy kit. Yeah. And I presume it's a nod to the history of the city as well, is it?
Yes, it's actually our third kit. Our away kit's not been announced yet. This is our third kit, so it is very much a special edition. But yeah, it's a nod to the chocolate that the city is renowned for. And a huge amount of credit has to go to Dan Simonite, who's our he's technically our media officer, though he did announce he was leaving yesterday, which is very sad. Who's helped design these kits and helped work on these colour schemes. It's an absolutely glorious kit. It has had so much credit across the footballing world. And I'm holding it up so that you can see more of it. But the reality is...
Yeah, people at home, that's pointless. But Kieran and I want to see more of it.
go and check it out on our socials, because it's a lovely kit and it's really well made. You know, I really like it. I'm not a big buyer of new kits. I've got a multitude of retro kits, but... I've bought all of them actually because our home kit as well is kind of this maroon kit, but it has almost elements of kind of the architecture of the Minster kind of within it as well. So they've absolutely made, you know, we can't take credit for it because it obviously happened before we took over. But they have absolutely nailed the centenary kit so far. It is our 100th year, so it's good that we've really kind of nailed that.
Yeah, so all you need is a picture of Richard III on the back and a Viking helmet. You've covered all the historical bases in York, pretty much. Jim, it's been really good to talk to you. It's so refreshing for us to have a positive story. I mean, we had, you know, we spoke to Swindon Supporters Trust, we followed their story, but that was after 2.5-3 years of chaos, basically. And yours is a bit, seemed to be an almost seamless transition, and we want to see that happening at War Club. So we wish you all the best going ahead. And seriously, that kit is just, well, it's lovely. Cheers, mate.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us on. I'm really happy that we're in the position we are, and happy to talk about it anytime.
It's a really interesting interview, Kieran. There's a couple of things. I'm old school, so that shocking revelation in the first minute of the interview that he's from a two-club family, I'd be calling him Geordie from now on. Every time I see him, you know, here he is, Geordie, Newcastle fan. But this is a really interesting deal, Kieran, because it's kind of like, I don't know how you describe it, a bloodless coup, a very civilised takeover to the extent that the outgoing owner is paying the rent for 10 years. I mean, normally we associate supporters club takeovers with almost the last resort, or certainly when a club is in trouble. So it's quite reassuring to see that a supporters group can take over a club in such a calm, smooth way, and then pass it on to somebody who can bring in even further investment.
Yes, yeah, it all seems very positive. Yeah, I agree with you entirely. For most supporters, club takeovers, they've had to do the role of Thunderbirds,
yeah,
and be international rescue as far as a local club is concerned. The Baroness named her son after one of the Thunderbird pilots, by the way.
Virgil?
That's giving away too much information.
Oh, of course it would be, yeah, of course. Well, there's only five of them, so it's
not Virgil.
I don't think Brains was a pilot. Before we get angry tweets, you know the sort of thing our listeners get.
Oh, I can imagine. I can imagine.
Yeah.
This seems really positive. You know, the owner whom the trust had originally sold the club to, I think he just reached a period of time where he felt that he had to move on, and everything was done very amicably, which shows that, you know, perhaps we've become too jaundiced in the 3 years that we've been doing this show, that there's so much bad news that, you know, the good news, it just tends to go under the radar.
Well, it also shows as well, Kieran, that supporters trusts now are way more than just a well-meaning group of individuals. They're very well-organised, sensible business people, because they had the foresight when they originally sold the majority of the shares to the club, to the owner that they just bought out again, to stipulate in the contract that they would have the first refusal when he wanted to sell those shares back.
Yes, so, and the price they paid was superb as well.
Yeah. So it does show you that the fan ownership model really has progressed, I think, in the 2.5 years we've been doing the pod. So it's very encouraging to have a nothing but good news story on the pod, and very interesting. Yes. And also, I can't stress enough how cool that chocolate and cream striped kit looked.
I've checked the website. It's back,
I know,
in stock.
I'm surprised. Do you know what? We interviewed Jim about an hour ago. I bet Ali a fiver that by the time we actually recorded this pod, you'd have bought one. Thanks to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod, that's very kind of you. Go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And don't forget, we will have some very interesting news for those of you who are Patreons or about to become Patreons shortly. And if you have a question you'd like answered on the show, then email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, as always, folks, thanks so much for the support. We are genuinely touched by the way that you hold us to account, and you seem to be enjoying the show, and really appreciate it. Patreon is one method of showing a bit of love for the show. But if you want to give us some good karma and genuinely make a difference, and producer guy tells us all about the algorithms, and myself and Kevin nod like dogs, and they've got no idea what he's talking about, but it does help us in the charts. It helps our credibility when we're trying to book guests as well. If you could give us a review, if you could give us 5 stars, it helps us in those charts, and we are punching with some pretty big hitters these days. Apparently, it doesn't matter what you say. in the review. The important thing is that you do give one. So you could even say you would rather have the show presented by Buster Bloodvessel of Bad Manners and Liz Truss of the Save the English Cheese Foundation.
Good Lord.
And it wouldn't make a blind bit of difference to me or Kevin.
I don't know if Buster Bloodvessel's still around, but he can't cope well in this heat, surely.
No. Well, the most violent gig I ever went to in my life was a Bad Manners gig in Brighton way back in the day. And it was one of those places which had two levels, and we were down sort of on the dance floor, and then about 15 skinheads turned up in full you know, shaved heads, full shit skinhead gear, with baseball bats, and just took out everybody on the dance floor. But it was great. Still a great gig.
Yeah. We lasted about three songs at a Bad Manners gig, and we thought, this is not the cuddly fat chap that we recognised from Top of the Pops. Some of these political views seemed slightly dodgy, as far as I'm concerned. I always liked it on Thunderbirds, by the way. I loved it when they used to cut to real hands.
Yes.
It always used to make me laugh. And I'm just saying that so we don't end the show on stories of a skinhead riot in the early 80s. Because I would like to think that this is the one BAFTA lasted all the way through to the end. Putting a lot of ticks in the columns going, actually, I'm glad I listened all the way through now. Oh, really? Okay. It's ruined it a bit. See you next time. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of football.